Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey. Joining me for the show tonight is my co-host, Richard Hurley. We have an exciting program tonight as we discuss many timely issues for the veterans. Thanks for joining us. It's a talk show, as you know, as well as a news show, so callers are welcome. In the United States and Canada, call 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. Richard, in the next hour, we have lots to discuss, as you know, including ideas for reforming the VA with the new Trump administration. We're going to talk some more about the new rules for Camp Lejeune veterans affected by contaminated drinking water, talk about Agent Orange issues, and if we have time, some of our own practical advice and resources for veterans who are looking for information and help. I'd like to begin, though, with, Richard, your experiences this past week. I understand you had a VA hearing in Montgomery, Alabama, at that regional office. So what can you share with us about that experience?
Yeah, sure did, David, and thank you very much, and good evening. As David said, I was up in Montgomery, Alabama, representing a veteran, and most people might not realize, although our offices are in Florida, we represent veterans throughout the country. And I found it very interesting being up there in Alabama, despite the fact that they were under the weather, having lost to Clemson earlier in the week. The decision review officer, the DRO as we call them, who presided over the case, was very friendly, and he could not have been more hospitable. And I bring this up, David, because as you know, when we go down to St. Pete, the regional office there, you know, it's just not the same feeling. It is an adversarial proceeding, and I understand that. I've been an advocate for 35 years as an attorney. But there's also a duty to assist the veteran, which is their policy that they're supposed to adhere to. And sometimes when I'm in St. Pete, I don't get that feeling that they're there to assist the veteran and assist David, you and I in helping to make their claim a successful one. And that was not the experience I had up in Alabama. This DRO could not have been more hospitable. And when we sat down, one of the things that you and I talk about, David, is telling our veterans, you know, when you're having your hearing, make sure you get it on tape. David, you and I, over the last 3 or 4 years, have had bad experiences where we have waived the tape proceeding and gone for what they call an informal proceeding. And we were convinced by the DRO, unfortunately, to have an informal proceeding, because they said, well, if you do an informal proceeding, I'll be able to resolve the case sooner, because when you have a formal or a tape proceeding, it takes 120 to 180 days to have the transcript transcribed. And that's just a bunch of garbage. And you and I have seen that over the last 3 or 4 years. The DRO in Montgomery said to me when I brought this to his attention, he kind of laughed. He said, it takes 30 days to transcribe a tape. And he also said during that period of time, he's working to try to resolve the case before that the tape even comes in. So I guess what I'm saying is that there was a complete different culture between what I experienced in Montgomery and what I experienced in St. Pete. And, you know, I would hope that, you know, these regional offices around the country would trade some of this information because it would make the whole process so much friendlier and more successful for the veteran. You know, when the hearing officer down in St. Pete is telling me, you know, You don't want to have this 120 and 180 days to have the tape transcribed. You know, you're just going to cause a further delay in getting the case resolved. That, like I said, that's a bunch of garbage, because it's, as you and I have found, we get all sorts of delays out there. It has nothing to do with 120 and 180 days to transcribe the tape. So I guess what I'm saying is that it was a great experience, and one I hope that I can see happen more frequently down in St. Pete.
Now, I think you would agree that St. Petersburg is one of the largest regional offices, certainly as far as veteran population that it's serving, probably much larger than the Montgomery, Alabama one, which the much heavier workload at St. Pete might be the VA's excuse for the longer delays. But you know, you and I have both been told that we go to these hearings and that they have to send them out. They've even mentioned sending them to San Diego to be transcribed, and using taking months to do that. So I think that it's an allocation. As I mentioned last week, I think it's a misallocation of resources. They've got about 900 employees or so working at the St. Pete regional office, but they have a huge veteran population in the state of Florida. They need to the VA, from the top down, needs to make sure that the busier offices have the resources. Otherwise, it's as you and I have discussed before, it's almost like there's different justice for veterans depending on what state they're living in. That's something that needs to be resolved, among many other things. And I'd like to
continue. On that point, David, I'm getting a number of veterans who are moving into the state of Florida, and they've already started their claims in other jurisdictions around the country. And one of the questions that they ask me is, well, should I have the case transferred to Florida down to St. Pete Regional Office? And my inclination today is no, don't do that. I want to see what your calendar looks like up there in Michigan or Montgomery or wherever else these cases are. And because if those cases are moving quicker up there and out of the state of Florida, then I'll keep them there rather than bring them into Florida.
Right. We did notice last year that with a veteran who had a case involving the Camp Lejeune contaminated water issues, that was handled. Apparently the VA had centralized the claims, the Camp Lejeune claims, at least at that time, to the Louisville, Kentucky regional office. And we had a video conference hearing with the decision review officer from Louisville, as you recall. But you know, we still had a long wait time after that hearing before we actually got a decision, which fortunately was successful.
Yeah, if you recall, the way that kind of came about, our client had already appeared on, I think it was Channel 8. And after that appearance on Channel 8 down in Tampa Station, within 10 days, I got the phone call from Louisville saying that they wanted to schedule this hearing for the upcoming Friday, like 6 days away. And right. He said, would you object if we did that? And I said, of course I wouldn't object. But he did agree, and he conceded that the reason our client got that quick hearing was because he, in fact, appeared on Channel 8 down in Tampa.
Right, and Channel 8 and some of the other local stations in the Tampa area, because there's such a large veteran population in the western part of Florida, they regularly are covering veteran stories. But when you and I talked to the reporter, the investigative reporter, on that particular show, I was trying to emphasize to him the point that we need a change in the system. Case by case is wonderful, particularly for that individual veteran, but they've got tens of thousands of cases backlogged at the St. Pete Regional Office. And I was hoping that the media would focus more on how can they improve the system for everybody by focusing on the mismanagement, the understaffing issue, and other issues that need to be recalled. But his reply, that reporter's reply was, well, you can only make so much of a difference, and perhaps it doesn't, it really doesn't show the individual impact, which they like, you know, for their media coverage. But the VA does respond to media, and that's why, you know, so many veterans are turning to the media, as well as they file congressional complaints, et cetera. But let's talk more about the overall topic of reforming the VA. As we mentioned last week, President Donald Trump has nominated the current Undersecretary for Health of the Veterans Health Administration, Dr. David Shulkin, to serve as the next VA Secretary. Dr. Shulkin has held the position of being the Undersecretary for Health since about July of 2015. And, man, I'd hate to be in his shoes as far as the heat he's going to get. As far as I could tell as of today, looking at the Senate Committee website, they have not yet scheduled his confirmation hearing, but I'm sure when they do, there's going to be a lot of questions from the senators and probably testimony from veterans groups about whether he should be confirmed. I think he probably will be, but what his agenda will be. And he's facing some really, really tough problems. Just in an article in the USA Today from last month, December 7th, 2016, Dr. Shulkin was interviewed about the state of the VA healthcare system, and he acknowledged that that as of November 15th of this past year, there were still more than 500,000 veterans who were waiting longer than 30 days to be seen for their very first appointment when they were new patients. More than 125,000 of them were waiting longer than 2 months, and 46,000 had been waiting more than 6 months for their first appointment. Now, keep in mind, this is still in the context of the Veterans Choice Program, which has been underway, you know, for the last year and a half. Richard, let me take a break. Doug, let's go to the caller. We have Jason on line three.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Jason.
Hey, Jason, how
are
you?
How you doing?
Very
good.
Doug.
How you doing today?
Good. Jason, what's your question?
Well, no, it wasn't really much of a question rather than a statement, definitely regarding what you guys are talking about. When it comes to culture is, you know, with all those individuals in all across the country, all these veterans, and our population here in Florida, and you made that comment of having those resources allocated to that area, a lot of it, and then you spoke of, News Channel 8, it really comes down, and I really think to it, to everything I said, but also within our areas, when you allocate those resources, is having more individuals like you guys, like Rick, and individuals from other organizations that are willing to really handle those issues, and veterans don't know where to go to get them. And I think that's why you guys have this, to get those resources out there. But I would just say, you're right. I'm allocating resources. When you have a population out here in Florida like we do, and the amount of funding that they have to be able to do certain things like that, it's absolutely a possibility, and there's no reason why they shouldn't. And when they definitely have people that want the employment as well. So,
right.
I think it is just a big misuse and doesn't favor any part of the veteran with how much hassle sometimes these veterans go through.
Right. So this is going to be a question presented to Dr. Shulkin, no doubt, about the allocation of resources. As you may have heard today, that President Trump, one of his first items of action today was to put a freeze on federal government hiring other than the military. So that suggests there's going to be a freeze on veteran hirings. And just a year ago, Dr. Shulkin was quoted as saying that they were 41,000 employees short. They had 41,000 vacancies on the healthcare side of the VA. That's nearly one in six positions in the VA healthcare side. And it's tough. They have
Absolutely.
A high turnover of personnel, especially for nurses. They have overall, morale problems. So there's a lot of challenges, and we'll talk more about some ideas. But thanks so much for calling, Jason.
No, absolutely. Anytime, I definitely love to get that information out there when it comes, what you guys are doing and, how these veterans can get the resources that are immense, really, out here in the communities. And when it gets to the VA, where to navigate those. So,
right.
There's a lot of organizations, specifically some, and that really help that. I'm on the board with a nonprofit, and I just when veterans need resources, especially here in Florida, they have to come, and we will reach out to them because they are there if they're willing to receive them.
Great. Thank you so much, and thanks for all your involvement, too, for veterans. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Thank you, Rich, and guys have a good night.
Thank you. Doug, let's take... thank you. Doug, let's take the call from Michael on line four, if he's still there.
Hello.
Yes, hello. Welcome.
Hey, Michael.
Yes.
Hey, how are you? How are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. This is a great thing you're doing here.
Thank you so much.
I've got kind of a multi-question, you know, a couple parts of my question. First of all, what can a veteran expect when he or she has a hearing before a judge of the Board of Veterans' Appeals?
That's a good question, because what Richard and I have been talking about in the first part of the show was a hearing before what they call a decision review officer, which is the first step of an appeal, but that decision review officer is still at the local regional office. Your question about the Board of Veterans' Appeals is the next level of an appeal. So if the veteran loses or is unhappy with the decision by the decision review officer at the regional office, the veteran can appeal up to the Board of Veterans' Appeals, and what they can expect is basically this. They can expect a wait of probably 3 or 4 years before they get a hearing that they request. Now, of course, they can waive the hearing. They can ask the board, the assigned judge, to make a decision based on the documentation, based on statements, the medical records, doctor's opinions, legal arguments, etc., by their representative. But even then, you're likely going to be waiting years. As far as what can they expect about the hearing, well, the good news for the veteran is that you don't have to travel to Washington, D.C. The Board of Veterans' Appeals is located in a building just a couple blocks north of the White House, but the VA does have it set up so that the veteran can have a hearing at the local regional office. Unfortunately, they may have to wait literally years to get that hearing, and it could be a hearing where the judge travels to that regional office, what they call them, the traveling judges, or it could be a live video conference hearing where the veteran, witnesses, and the representative are in a conference room over at the St. Pete Regional Office or whatever regional office around the country they're at. And they're watching the judge on a large screen TV, and the judge is able to observe them live, and they testify. There's testimony and everything presented that way. The hearings are not supposed to be adversarial, and usually the judges are without exception, professional, and they're typically not giving veterans third degree, but they will sometimes ask very pointed questions. The judges tend to be extremely experienced in veterans law, and their decisions tend to be much more thorough as far as fact-finding, as far as legal findings, than what you get out of the regional office. That doesn't mean that the decisions are perfect, because there's a possibility to appeal those decisions up further, but anyway, so hopefully that answers your question about what can a veteran expect. You said you had another part
also,
of the question.
They're also very, right, very more prepared, David.
Say again, Richard. Go ahead.
The federal judges are more prepared for the hearings than you're going to find at the regional level. So
that's true.
The hearing itself is very professional, and the fact-finding process is more successful. Most of the DROs that I've found, a lot of them haven't even read the file. Some of the DROs show up and say, well, this isn't my file. It actually belongs to somebody else. I'm just covering it for them. So
right.
So the hearing at that level is problematic.
Right, right.
What can a veteran do to prepare for the hearing?
Well, what the veteran needs to do is, first of all, have a good representative. It doesn't necessarily have to be a lawyer, but it needs to be an experienced representative, let's say a veteran service officer or a lawyer, that's handled these cases before, that they take the opportunity, that long waiting period before they get a hearing, to look and ask themselves, how can they strengthen the case, either with more thorough statements, witness statements, statements from the veteran, trying to get disability questionnaires completed by their private doctors, possibly to substantiate the level of disability that they have and the diagnosis. So those are things that should be done while they're waiting for the hearing. And the other thing that the veteran needs to keep in mind is, while the system is terribly backlogged with literally across the country hundreds of thousands of cases, pending BVA review, the BVA will move a case ahead on the docket. They'll advance a case on the docket in a situation where, let's say, the veteran is terminally ill, is 75 or older, or is facing serious financial trouble, like on the verge of becoming homeless. So keep those exceptions in mind if unfortunately any of those situations apply to that veteran, and ask the board to advance the case on the docket. They will, and we've been successful with some of our clients who have fallen in those situations. So as far as the other part of your question, what can veterans be doing, I think one thing that, particularly with the new administration coming in, it's a prime opportunity to improve the system, because we saw even after Secretary McDonald took office about 2.5 years ago, he did make some changes, but there's still a lot of room for improvement, a lot of changes that are probably going to happen. So what I'm saying is this: veterans ought to contact their two U.S. senators from their state and their representative in the House of Representatives, and let them know, trying to end this backlog once and for all. And if I could put in a pitch for one of our ideas, our law firm ideas, is we've started a petition to the White House. It's under whitehouse.gov, We the People petition. We started just the other day. If you go to our law firm website of CoreyandHurleyLawGroup.com, right on the home page, you'll see a link where you can go to the White House petition. We're petitioning the White House to focus on this problem of ending the backlog of hundreds of thousands of VA cases where veterans have to wait for years. It has a huge human impact on these veterans. You know, they're not rich people. They're disabled. They can't work, many of them, and they need this money just to survive. So that's my question. I hope that information is helpful to you, Michael.
Yes, the information was very helpful. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for calling. Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Thank you. So, Richard, there are a lot of things facing Secretary Shulkin, and I expect he's going to be grilled by the Senate committee during the confirmation hearing about the wait times. In this USA Today article from last month, he was interviewed, and whenever he was asked about the fact that more than 500,000 veterans were still waiting longer than a month to be seen for the first appointment, his answer was basically that half of those 500,000, or about 250,000, were for what he considered minor needs like dental, hearing, vision, and diet consultation. And he was quoted as saying, "I can sleep at night," he said. "The ones I worry about are the ones who can't wait or shouldn't be waiting. So that's where our entire focus of our system is right now."
You know, David, that's all fine and good, but you talked earlier about the fact that I think you read somewhere where there were 41,000 jobs that were understaffed at the VA.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, we always say that these politicians, they always say that the veteran comes first. Well, I would think that the medical care for the veteran should come first too. So, you know, why aren't we paying some of these doctors the kinds of salaries that they're getting in other hospitals?
Right.
I mean, you know, I hate to say this, but you know, amongst us lawyers and other people, we seem to feel like the services that are being offered to the veteran isn't as good as they would get in the private sector, and that needs a change. And the way you change it is you start paying these doctors. You know, we represent a number of veterans who work at the VA, and I ask them about, you know, what are their biggest complaints, and they say we're underpaid and overworked.
Yep.
And you know, I say, well, why don't you leave? If you don't like it, leave. They say, well, you know, I get a pension here, I get other stuff here, and I really can't afford to, you know, whether it's a family situation or some other situation, I can't afford to lose this job right now.
Right.
So that, you know, if you pay them, maybe we'd start getting some better medical care for the veteran.
But even with the experience you have talking to some of those employees, the VA reports a high rate of turnover for nurses in particular. And I think from what I've read, the morale is pretty low, and part of it has to be because they are so shorthanded, understaffed, and the workload and all the negative press has got to wear down on the morale of the employees at the VA. So that's going to be a tough thing for the incoming secretary to tackle. Now, in doing some research about Dr. Shulkin, I came across an article that he wrote that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine just this past year, and he was addressing basically the VA healthcare crisis and how, in his view, the VA system could become, as he called it, a high-performance healthcare network. And he basically concluded that part of what he felt would be a good reform would be to create a network that had three groupings of healthcare providers. The core network would be the existing VA-run hospitals, clinics, and other medical centers, as well as other facilities run by other medical federal agencies, and also academic teaching institutions that are already have established relationships with the VA, such as in our area in Tampa, the University of South Florida. But the second network, with which Dr. Shulkin recommended having, would be what he called an organized private sector delivery system that meets certain performance standards for clinical outcomes, appropriate criteria, access standards, and service levels. And they would have, it would be a competitive process where these private healthcare providers would then apply to be part of this network, and they would be sent veterans for coordinated medical care. And then the third network would allow veterans to obtain care from other participating private sector providers, particularly for veterans who don't live within a reasonable distance of providers that are in the other networks, which he's talked about. So some people have said that those ideas are essentially privatizing the VA. I don't think that's an accurate statement, because it's not as if they're going to shut down the existing VA medical system. They're certainly not going to do anything close to that. But they are going to be relying more on the private sector. And whenever the VA is understaffed by, 40,000 healthcare providers, what else are they going to do? There's a shortage of certain areas of doctors and nurses around the country as it is. So what else are they going to do? You have any thoughts on this, Richard?
Well, Dr. Shulkin, he's been the undersecretary under Secretary Robert McDonald, which I think you would agree at this point has been a failed system. So he has been a part of that process and the people and the culture, although he is a good candidate. I think his recommendations are probably pretty good ones. How they get implemented is something else. But, we're talking about the medical side, and you and I always talk, there's the medical side and there's the compensation side. And you and I deal more on the compensation side than
right.
we do the medical side. And
right.
unfortunately, with McDonald and now with Shulkin, all we're hearing about is the medical side. How are we going to improve the medical side? Well, to be candid with you, I've got a number of veterans that come in here every day who get treated by the VA, and they don't have any complaints about the medical side. They're very
right.
happy, you
right.
know. So let's start talking about the compensation side, which is what a lot of these veterans really need and deserve. And I think they've been given the short stick.
I know you had an experience just today, Richard, in trying to get an answer from the BVA on a particular case. Can you share with us what happened today when you were contacting the BVA?
Yeah, I've got a client came in today, and the claim goes back to 2002. And his case has been sitting with the BVA since 2015. And I called up there, and it was busy for 25 minutes, and I couldn't get through. I finally had to shoot him an email and ask them to get back to me, explain what the case was about, the fact that it's almost 15 years old now, and the fact that the BVA has had the case for almost 2 years, and we have no answer. So at this point, I've not heard from the BVA. I've checked my emails today, and I've received nothing. But, you know, there again, here's the frustration. Imagine the frustration for us when the client comes in and they're looking at you and they're explaining to you, you know, how long this has been. I mean, this case for this veteran's been going on long before you and I got into their case. And he comes
right.
in and all he wants is an answer. And
right.
I can't give it to him. I can't give it to him. I pick up the phone and call. I still can't give it to him.
Right.
And he's relying upon me to provide him with an answer.
Right.
So when the BVA is not picking up their phone, there's something wrong here. So maybe we can hire more people to pick up the phone up at the BVA. How about that?
Right, right. Well, something has to be done. As I said earlier, you know, with the incoming administration, whether people support Trump or not really isn't the point. The point is it's an opportunity where there's going to be some changes that are going to be made and hopefully more accountability throughout the VA, not just on the healthcare side, but on the benefits side, on the claim side, because the VA will track. They'll tell you they track the processing times of initial claims, but they don't track, or at least they don't report to the public, you know, specific waiting times. We have general ideas because they will send letters saying your expected time for a BVA hearing may be X number of hundreds of days, which is always is a lowball figure. So we obviously have a general idea that it's going to be a long time, but the BVA is really doing nothing about it. They need a lot of pressure from Congress, and hopefully the White House will take an interest. Take an interest in that. Now, as far as other things that a veteran can be doing, you mentioned emailing and calling the BVA. What I've found in the last year or so that, you know, we've done a lot of emailing to folks at the regional office. The regional office decision review officers, they rarely, I mean, there's maybe a group of about 30 of them or so. The number may fluctuate with turnover, but they never want to give out their private number. We've had a couple that have, but a few of them don't even want to give out their email number or the email address. A couple of them have, but what we've been doing in the last year has been just to fire off emails to the regional office's appeals team or their inquiries team, because we will get answers, not always answers that we like, but they're usually more pointed answers than you get. Then if you go to the VA.gov website and you submit an inquiry through their IRIS, what they call the inquiry system, IRIS is the acronym, system where they tell you they'll get back to you within 5 business days. I've used that many times, and you never really get a responsive answer. You get an answer that just raises more questions about the case because it's being handled by someone at the customer service center. And unlike at the regional office where we may actually get people to dig in a little deeper. So I hope listeners out there will share with us their ideas, but also share with members of Congress and contact the White House. Like I say, sign that petition that we've started. Go to CoreyandHurleyLawGroup.com. On the homepage, there's a link so you can go to the White House We the People petition to petition the White House to pay attention to this backlog issue and to solve it. Once for all, we're not naive. We know it's not going to happen overnight. The VA is facing tremendous problems and budget problems, et cetera. But something has got to be done. If not now, when? I've been handling VA cases now for almost 20 years since I left active duty in the late 90s, and the system has really gotten even worse as far as the backlog. And we can. Segue into some of our other topics tonight, like the Camp Lejeune issue, and that points to an even greater potential backlog, I think, because you're going to have untold numbers, maybe tens of thousands of Camp Lejeune veterans filing cases, and that's opened the door to the possibility somewhere down the road that veterans have served at other bases with environmental contamination problems, of which there are many, may start pressing the VA for compensation as well. Richard, what are your thoughts on some of these things?
Before we do that, David, let's remind our listeners the telephone number to call in, 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. 6008. We'd love to hear from the listeners as to what their experiences might be having dealt with the VA, or just your thoughts about the new administration coming in. You know, David, one of the things about Shulkin, I'm originally from New Jersey, and I'm familiar with the hospitals that he managed, and he was very successful there. So, you know, on another side, I know I've been kind of bashing the process here, but there is some, I think, some hope with Dr. Shulkin that maybe he might have an answer to some of the problems, certainly not all of the problems. You know, maybe just hope, we can just hope.
Right. And whenever he went through his confirmation hearing to be the undersecretary, this is back in 2015, Dr. Shulkin did mention his experience at the New Jersey Hospital. I have a copy of his testimony from 2015, and he said at that time he was the president of Morristown Medical Center, a large tertiary care hospital in northern New Jersey, and he provided leadership during a period of great transformation. Over the previous 5 years, they've been recognized by a couple organizations as the best overall hospital in New Jersey in almost all clinical categories, identified as the safest hospital in the state by Consumer Reports, and applauded by other organizations for their expertise. So he had experience in transforming, improving that organization, and certainly he came into the VA with his eyes open about the many problems, whether it's the staffing problems, you had the waiting time scandal where people were in the VA were basically falsifying numbers for the wait time, putting into the computers that there was zero wait time, when in fact the veterans were waiting for months, and some veterans and some hospitals actually died waiting. And as I mentioned earlier from that USA Today article from last month, there's still a waiting time problem. And, you know, Dr. Shulkin in the interviews has focused on the fact that things that are requiring urgent care, he pointed out that during the time since he took over in 2015, that the waiting time for urgent care has decreased from 57,000 to 600. He's still trying to get the same-day care, though. You know, the example he gave was if someone has a lung nodule, then they need to be seen immediately. If they need something like, you know, a new pair of glasses, then that's certainly a poor customer service problem. He understands that. But so he's going to have huge challenges. It'll be interesting to see what Congress does to support him, because he certainly can't do it alone. There's already been ideas by some members of Congress about holding the VA more accountable, giving even more power to the secretary to fire VA employees that are not performing well or engaged in misconduct. And there are already, in the last few weeks, Congress passed a bill that, as part of this accountability, I think that it's actually just picking around the edges, where they passed a law that said that reprimands for VA employees can be kept in their files permanently, not just for 2 years. I think, well, geez, that's really minutia. That's not transforming the VA, and that's probably, having worked both in the military and in the private sector as a lawyer, I know what's going to happen. People just aren't going to be issued reprimands, and that's really not going to have much of an impact. Go ahead.
I remember situations where I'd go down to the regional office in St. Petersburg, and I'd be checking on some of our cases, and especially the cases that were on remand from the BVA. And as you know, whenever there's a remand from the BVA, there's case law that says right on point that these cases must be expedited by the regional office,
right,
and get them resolved. And so when I mentioned this to the staffer at the St. Pete Regional Office, room 222, the infamous 222, they just look at me and roll their eyes and say, you know, that's fine for the BVA, but this is a whole different ballgame down here.
Right.
And I would look at them and say, but wait a second. You're under a court order. You're under a court order that says you've got to expedite this case. And they just kind of shrug their shoulders, and you know what that means. It means that nothing's going to happen.
Right.
So it gets back to that whole accountability and the culture that Dr. Shulkin's going to have to deal with when he gets appointed.
And with President Trump's freeze on federal government employee hiring, other than for the military branches, one can only imagine the impact that's going to have, not just on morale, because they're still going to have some turnover, I would expect, as people leave and retire. Are they going to be filling those vacancies and make the situation even worse? When I was on active duty, you know, we went through in the early 90s major cutbacks after the first Gulf War was over. Then there were downsides to the military. And the saying then was, we must do more with less. You know, and that's a really interesting expression, I guess, but it really gets on people, because you can only expect so much of people as far as working, however dedicated they are. And then you're dealing with the fact that although a lot of VA employees are veterans themselves, they're no longer in the military. And they expect to be able to work, you know, 7:30 to 4:30 or 8 to 5 and get paid for overtime. They're civil service employees now. So it's a completely different culture. And I think many people would say it's a fair observation that, you know, civil service employees, they're very tough to fire if they're not performing. Very tough. And what we've observed is there's really, it's kind of a low energy, no sense of urgency environment over there. So they may be told by Washington, no help is coming. You know, no one's called the support team to rescue you from your 30,000 cases backlogged at St. Petersburg Regional Office. You're going to have to do more with less. It ain't going to happen. So meanwhile, we've got to put the heat on the VA, because people's lives and you know, their way of life and their standard of life are dramatically affected. We see that with many of our clients. So we'll see. With
David, David, you and I were communicating earlier with a friend of ours who is in the building business, and he was involved with some VA facilities that were either under construction or being built, and he had some very interesting, and I know you were looking into this, I think one of the projects was in Denver, and the waste that was going on.
Oh, the Denver Medical Center out there, which was being constructed, a new medical facility, and originally the budget for it was $800 million, and things, essentially, the project unraveled. And the budget went from about $800 million to $1.6 billion. The project is probably a few years away from being completed now, but the critics of it, the VA did do an investigation because of the contracting problems. When one contractor basically said, we can't do this. The VA is making too many changes. The VA is expecting us to basically bear the cost of all these changes. And the VA had planned for really extravagant things for this medical center that focus more on appearance, such as what the walls are made out of, what the floors are made out of, that actually were no longer consistent with good medical standard of care issues. So it was not only wasting a lot of money, but ultimately it was going to be tougher for the doctors, nurses, and other medical providers there to do their jobs. So that's just one example. But yeah, the individual you were talking about, you know, he also commented that you know, he will no longer do VA construction contracts. It's just too much, and you may get into a contract dispute with them. It might eventually get resolved in your favor, but only after a year or two. And meanwhile, he has the same observations of the VA employees that we have, which is basically, you better stay away from the parking lot by late afternoon or you're going to get run over by them as they rush out to leave from work. There's, you're only going to get so much. This is not active duty military where people can, you know, can be asked to work 18-hour days or longer. It's a completely different culture, and veterans need to keep that in mind. The system needs to change. But in any event, I want to touch quickly on Camp Lejeune and some other issues, because we've got just about 10 minutes left in our show tonight. And as I mentioned last week, on January 13th of this year, the VA finally published their final regulations on diseases that they would presume are associated with exposure to contaminated drinking water at Camp Lejeune for veterans that served there between August 1st of 53 and December 31st of 1987. Veterans who had served there for no less than 30 days, consecutive or non-consecutive. So if you served there for 28 days or 29 days, even if you got one of these eight different diseases, you're out of luck, my friend. It's not the presumption will not cover you. Now, we might be able to argue with the doctor's opinion that day or two shouldn't make a difference, but you're dealing with the regulation now, and the VA is probably going to put up a fight. But the eight diseases which are now covered by this presumptive service connection are the following: kidney cancer, liver cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, adult leukemia, multiple myeloma, Parkinson's disease, aplastic anemia, and other myelodysplastic syndromes, and bladder cancer. Those are the eight. It's a shorter list than the 15 diseases that are on the health care coverage side that was enacted by a law passed by Congress. Keep in mind that health care coverage, which was enacted, I believe, in 2012, an act by Congress. This new change, which I mentioned on the benefit side, was a regulation by the VA. And the VA chose, because what they believed were, you know, the scientific proof, to only service connect those eight. Now, what this does is open the door to the VA having to pay what has been projected may be more than $2 billion in disability benefits over the next few years to those veterans who served at Camp Lejeune. But it also opens the door to other veterans that are going to be pressing, you know, in the sort of me too or why not. You know, I had a similar situation at my base, they're going to say. And I noticed in reading the VA's explanation behind the regulation that there are a number of veteran organizations that provided information about, in response to, you know, this proposed regulation that then became finalized 10 days ago. One of those organizations was called the Fort McClellan Veteran Stakeholders Group. Now, Fort McClellan, Alabama, was an Army post that was built during World War One. In other words, around for a long time, and it had a long history of contamination, not only because of the chemical warfare materials used on the base, but also alleged contamination by a private company, I think it was Monsanto, that was in that area. But in any event, that's just one example. There are many other installations around the country with contamination, and we'll have to see how that develops.
David, we're getting close to the end here.
Yes.
We like to... So all the veterans that are listening, we like to offer some tips with regard to their claims, especially if you're going it alone, which we do not recommend you do, or if you have a VSO, or even if you have an attorney. Our method has been pretty successful. So one of the things that we always have our clients do in preparation for their hearing, whether it's at the initial level at the regional office or at the DVA level on appeal to the federal court, is to write a personal statement. Now the VA gives you these forms, especially for PTSD, and it's a block that's about 3 inches long. And a lot of veterans that I've seen in the past is they try to get their story fit in that little 3 inches. And, you know, here's a veteran that served in Vietnam in 1966, 67, served a year over there. And now, 40 years later, he's writing his story. Well, how are you going to fit that into a little block? So there's no objection to being able to take that little block and saying, please see the attached pages, and you can have 10, 15 pages if you want. So when you're writing your statement, make them self-explanatory so that a person can understand your situation without having to follow up with more questions. Include dates and places when describing the event. If you can't recall an exact date, provide the best estimate you can. The more detailed, the better. The more detailed lends itself to more credibility.
Avoid using abbreviations that a VA employee, even if a veteran, may not know. Remember that that each branch of the military has its own jargon. So write to your audience, which is the VA employee, who wasn't in your unit, may not know what your jargon means, and may not even have served in the military. Be very thorough in describing your symptoms. Remember to include dates of what you describe, since symptoms may change over time. Remember the importance of showing continuity of your disability. For example, just because you injured your back in 1975 doesn't mean the VA will believe your back disability in 2017 is related to that injury. Therefore, describe the history of your condition and its symptoms in detail. Remember, it often requires a doctor to provide the connection, or what the VA calls the nexus, between your current disability and what happened in the military. This is very important, because when you get in front of the DRO, and the DRO hopefully will read that statement before he even meets you, he'll have a good idea about who you are and where you served and what you endured. Very similar to appearing in court. If you're going to go to court for a traffic violation, you're not going to show up in a pair of blue jeans and a T-shirt with a Budweiser insignia on it. I would hope you'd show up with a sport jacket, a white shirt, and a tie, and shoes rather than sneakers. You know, that judge then gets the first impression, you know, that perspective. That lends itself to a lot of credibility in your part. And so when you're asking the judge for a little leeway here, he's bound to give it to you. Or more often than not, give it to you, as opposed to if you show up looking like you just got off the back of a beer wagon. So, you know, this is one tip, and throughout our year on the show, we'll be giving you many, many more tips to assist the veteran. And again, you know, we do not recommend you ever doing this on your own. I'm looking at the books right now. They're like 6,000 pages long in that fine print that David always talks about, much like you see in the Bible. It's very difficult to read and very difficult to know. So don't go it alone. Get a representative, but in my opinion, go get yourself a good lawyer.
So that's all great advice. And the VA website, va.gov, excellent resource, just a ton of information there. Our website, our law firm website, CoreyandHurleyLawGroup.com. We basically created to be a library of resources, hopefully in a very user-friendly way, to help people, even if they aren't our clients. Now, before we go, because we just got a few minutes left, I want to emphasize something that's very important. Veterans, if you know any veteran who is in a crisis of any kind or suicidal, and veterans have a higher than usual suicide rate. A lot of veterans suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. The VA has a veterans crisis line to help, and their number is 1-800-273-8255, and then you press the number 1, and that's 1-800-273-8255, and then press the number 1. That's the veterans crisis line. So use it for veterans that are in a crisis. They're there to help. And there's so much more, and we have time to share. But go to our website, Corey and Hurley Law Group. Lots of good advice there. And please don't forget, sign that petition. We have to use every means we can to communicate to Washington that the system needs attention, particularly the claim side. We know Dr. Shulkin is the incoming, what I expect to be the incoming VA secretary. His focus, as it should be, and with his background, is going to be to fix the health care side as best as he can. And we hope they will also give attention to the claim side. So go to CoreyandHurleyLawGroup.com, and on the homepage you'll see a link to the petition to the White House to end this ridiculous VA backlog, where people are waiting years and years, particularly if their case is on appeal. So now I think it's time for us to be wrapping up. I'd like to thank all of you that listened in, and our callers to the show here on BBS Radio. As you know, it's a weekly show. We'll be here every Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain Time, and 6 p.m. Pacific. You can listen to the show through the show's website, which is bbsradio.com/the Veterans News Hour. And we'd like to thank once again our producer at BBS Radio, Doug Newsom, for the great job he's doing for us, as always. We'd also like to invite listeners to become show guests. If you have an area, let's say you work for a nonprofit group helping veterans, you want to talk about that, call us. If you want to be a sponsor or advertiser, call me, 813-662-0760. We'd love to hear from you. And Richard's number is 727-612-1515. That's 727-612-1515. Thanks again for calling, and please tune in next week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.